Well, it's February, which means we should be far enough away from Christmas for me to safely ask, what's the worst gift you have ever received? I'm not asking what's the worst gift you've ever given, because of course you've probably given a dud or two. I'm asking, what's the worst gift you have ever received? While you're thinking about some answers to that, let me share a few answers that people provided on the website, whydidyougetmethat.com. A donation made to an organization that I don't support. A bag of cotton balls. A partially used Kohl's gift card with $17.32 left on it. A tire iron from my husband on Valentine's Day. A home drug test. Thanks, Grandma. Deodorant from the guy who works at the deli where I buy my bagels before work. A turquoise mankini. I'm 60 years old and weigh 250 pounds. And my personal favorite, because it's the worst, a pill vial in the shape of an elephant that was filled with the baby teeth of my friend's children. What? You know, if that isn't proof that some gifts just shouldn't be given, I don't know what is. Then again, there is the opening chapter of the book of Daniel. Three times in Daniel chapter 1, it says, the Lord gave. And while two of God's gifts are good, like he gives Daniel wisdom and he gives Daniel favor, one of God's gifts isn't so good, at least not on the surface. That's because God gives his people into the hands of their enemies. God gives his people into exile. And that's actually what makes the book of Daniel so unique. You know, the Old Testament is largely written from within the friendly confines of Israel. And as such, it's largely about how to live with people who share your faith. The book of Daniel is different, however. The book of Daniel is about life in exile. It's about how to live in a world that is at best indifferent to your faith and at times opposed to it. Now, a few things as we get started today. First of all, Daniel chapter 1, 1 through 21 is our passage today. If you want to join me there, that's on page 1337 in the Bibles under your seats. Number two, the NIV translation, which is the Bibles under your seats, does not technically say the Lord gave all three times, which is unfortunate because the Hebrew actually does say that. That's why many other English translations say the Lord gave. We're going to pretend that the NIV is like other translations and pretend that it says the Lord gave all three times. And we're going to spend most of our time talking today about the first gift that God gives. That would be the so-called bad gift. Number three, we're going to discuss a lot of small applications along the way. And all those small applications are going to add up to one big application. And that big application is not that you and I should isolate, that we should circle the wagons and protect ourselves from the world around us. That application is also not to accommodate, to live like chameleons so that there's virtually no difference between us and the world around us. The application is to engage. It is to be faithful to God, but do so in a way that actually impacts the world around us. That's what people of faith do in the book of Daniel. And that's actually what God calls us to do as well. No, it's not that we live in exile. It's just that we do live in a world that is often indifferent to our faith and sometimes opposed to it. And we may not be in positions of power. We may not be politicians like Daniel eventually is in this book. But it's okay, because we can still make a difference, because the work that God calls us to is not a matter of position or power. It's actually about being faithful to God in all things, including the small things, because that is often where God does some of his most surprising work. We get a glimpse of that today in Daniel chapter 1, which I invite you to join me in reading. Daniel 1, verses 1 through 21. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put it in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Among those who were chosen were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. The chief officials gave them new names: to Daniel, the name Belteshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and to Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. So God caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, "I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these 4 young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in the whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. All right, not to pick on the NIV, but here's what verses 1 and 2 literally say. In the 3rd year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles from the temple of God. Now, however you say it, this is the single greatest tragedy in the history of Judah. Judah being the one remaining piece of the once nation of Israel. Now, if you want to know a little bit of the backstory about this tragedy, you can read about it in a book called Lamentations. Just know that Lamentations, which is 2 books before Daniel, is called Lamentations for a reason. There, the prophet Jeremiah describes in shocking detail how this unprecedented suffering that the nation of Babylon inflicted on his homeland for about 3 decades, from about 605 to 587 B.C., thousands were slaughtered, and those who survived did so by doing unspeakable things like eating their own children. It's a horrific scene. The thing is God had warned that exile would come upon his people if they continued to reject him. And God was faithful with his people in Judah for 400 years. But God finally relented, and he kept his word, and he used the empire of Babylon as an instrument of judgment against his people, not to destroy them, but actually to drive them back to him. What you find is the exile, as horrific as it is, actually is a turning point for the nation of Judah, for the Jews. It actually is the thing that drives them back to God. That leads us to 2 applications right away. I told you there were some small ones. They're coming quickly. The first one is this, is to recognize that God is in control of all things. This event known as the Babylonian captivity is not an accident. And neither is it simply a matter of a more powerful nation conquering a less powerful nation. God gives his people into the hands of his enemy. He sends them into exile himself. Again, not as a means of destruction, but for his purposes. And his purposes, application number 2, are to draw people to himself. And if I were to ask you, why are you here today? You might answer that in a number of ways. You might say, well, because this is what we do on Sundays. We go to church. Or you might say, because I'm here looking for some answers. Or you might say, because I have a drug problem. Someone drugged me to church today. Sorry for the dad joke. That may be true, in part, What the book of Daniel tells us, and really what the rest of Scripture tells us, is that we're ultimately here because God is actively drawing us to Himself. God uses all things for His purposes. Other nations, exiles, suffering. God uses things in our lives, all things in our lives, whether that is the invitation of a friend or the dragging of a parent or the weekly routine that we participate in or unexpected hardship and suffering. He uses all these things for His purposes to draw us to Himself. Not to force Himself on us, but to reveal Himself so we might catch a glimpse, so we might see the goodness of His kingdom. In the case of Daniel, God uses the horrific events described in verses 1 and 2 to draw Judah back to Himself. And He does so because He intends to use the people of Judah to actually draw people from Babylon to Himself. Which is a bit ironic because Babylon is absolutely committed to drawing Jews away from God. Now, Babylon is about 1,000 miles away from Jerusalem from following the nearest trade route, but it might have been a million miles away, spiritually speaking. And that's exactly why Daniel and his friends are taken to Babylon. Now, eventually, everyone who is conquered in Judah will be exiled to Babylon, but Babylon has a plan, and that is to start with some young men, to start with the best of the best. The people with the noblest of bloodlines, the people with the highest SAT scores, the people with the greatest leadership potential. Babylon begins with young men like that because they know if they can capture these young potential leaders, then other people will eventually follow them. And Babylon had a strategy that there was basically four parts to their strategy of trying to win the hearts and minds of young leaders. The first was disorientation, that is, taking people to Babylon. I don't know if you noticed this, but there are no parents mentioned in this passage, even though Daniel and his friends were probably about 13 or 14 years old at the time. This is actually intentional. Babylon knew that if you could get young, impressionable minds away from the influence of their parents, and you could present them with a world that had all sorts of wonders that they could only dream about and perhaps couldn't even imagine, then you could actually win their hearts. Think Pinocchio on Pleasure Island. Like on performance-enhancing drugs. This is Babylon's strategy. Now, Babylon was built as a paradise to the gods. In fact, the name Babylon means gateway to God. Babylon was built on the Euphrates River, which is impressive enough, but Babylon had actually developed a canal system that ran throughout the city that they used for rapid transit, a bit like modern-day Venice. Then there was Babylon's walls. There are at least three of them, with the outer wall being about 25 feet thick. The outer wall of Babylon was so wide on top that two chariots could pass each other on top without touching. Passing through the walls, you would see all sorts of ornate imagery in gold and blue brick. And in the middle of the city, you would find a ziggurat. That is a 30-story skyscraper that had a virtual heliport on top where the Babylonian god Marduk was said to land to meet with his people. Then there were the gardens that King Nebuchadnezzar built for his wife, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, which were both beautiful and provide a place of refuge, an oasis in the middle of the desert. Babylon had everything that your heart could want, and it's why it left every heart vulnerable to plunder. Like this story I heard about recently from a town in Tennessee, where two people knocked on the door of a home, and when the man opened the door, he found a man and a woman, and the woman said to the man that was with her, she asked if he would go home to get her cigarettes. And then she proceeded to ask the homeowner if he would mind if she swam in his pool. Now, before he could answer, she qualified her request. She asked if he would mind if she swam in the pool in the nude. He obliged, and she proceeded to skinny dip for the next 20 minutes. The homeowner presumably stayed the whole time. In fact, he was even so kind to hand her a towel when she was done. Police say that when she was done, she put her clothes on and left, and the homeowner discovered that he had been robbed blind. Now, that's not exactly what happens in Babylon, but it's pretty close. Can you imagine how alluring all of these things must have seemed to people who grew up in the backwoods of Judah? Small town Israel, and suddenly you find all these things that you could only dream about. In fact, you couldn't even dream about. It's no wonder that fewer than 10% of Jews who were taken to exile returned to Israel when they were set free. Less than 10%. The vast majority of people fell in love with Babylon because they were in capture, they were enraptured by all the things that they discovered there. Which makes me have to ask, like, what is it that captures your heart in our culture? What is it that woos you from our world? What is it that tempts you to turn away from God? That's the first part of Babylonian strategy, disorientation. Part two was indoctrination. What that meant is Babylon took Jewish exiles and they enrolled them in Babylon schools. They put them in Babylonian schools so they could learn Babylon's language, so they could learn their literature and all of their works. Now, Babylonian works aren't all bad. In fact, they're quite remarkable. Babylon made some remarkable discoveries in science and mathematics that we still follow today. It's just that not everything in Babylonian literature was true. Because Babylonian literature is full of religious propaganda. Even in their math and science textbooks, there are tales about pagan gods and magicians and spells and sorcerers. And that's the problem. I mean, can you see how someone who says, you know, the Babylonians are right about so many things. Maybe they're right about everything. And I think it's an experience some people have when they go to college. You meet professors who are brilliant in so many things, and suddenly you think that means that they're brilliant about everything, including their views of God, even if they don't believe God exists. Or it still happens today where you see people who are so successful and so powerful and so wealthy and they seem so happy and you assume, well, they must have figured it out. What's interesting about Daniel and his friends in Babylon is they don't resist Babylon's learning. That is, they don't protest going to Babylonian school and say, no, we only go to Jewish schools. They actually go to school and they excel. And this is actually helpful because not only did these young men learn some valuable lessons about the real world, they learned remarkable things about math and science before anyone else in Israel did. They also learned some important things about Babylon's worldview. They understood the spirituality of Babylon, which gives them a helpful starting point for having conversations of faith. It's hard to talk to someone about faith if you don't know where they're coming from. Well, Daniel and his friends learned where they're coming from, and it gave them a starting point for talking about their God, Yahweh, the God of Israel. Speaking of the God of Israel, that's where part three of Babylon's strategy comes into focus. Part three was the changing of names. Now, Jewish names were connected to the Jewish God. For example, Daniel means God is my judge. Hananiah means Yahweh is gracious. Mishael, who is what God is? And Azariah, Yahweh helps. Babylon took these names away and they gave Daniel and his friends new names that bore the marks of Babylonian gods like Bel and Nabu. Now, this is similar to other parts of the world where there's legislation where, you know, you don't allow Muslim women to cover their heads, or Jewish men to wear yarmulkes, or Christians to wear crosses. This is getting rid of obvious outward expressions of faith, or it's assigning new expressions of faith. Finally, part four of Babylon's strategy is food, provision. And this is where everything comes to a head, which may seem strange to us because we're like, eating with someone, what's the big deal? We're about to eat a whole bunch of baked potatoes in a minute here. What's the deal? Well, it's a big deal because in the ancient world, eating with someone was a sign of allegiance to them. It was a sign of relationship with them. And regularly eating at someone's table was in essence like making a covenant to them. What Nebuchadnezzar is asking Jewish exiles to do is to eat from his table. That's on par with him saying, you are making a covenant with me, which thereby ends their covenant with God. What he's saying is, I'm your provider now, and I am your king now. This is why Daniel and his friends resist. Again, they didn't resist the other things. They didn't resist going to Babylonian school. In fact, they got straight A's there. They didn't resist getting new names, even if they probably didn't agree with the theology behind it. And I'm sure they enjoyed so many of the good things that Babylon had to offer. It was a pretty remarkable place. It's just that they draw the line here. Because they chose for themselves that they could not swear allegiance to anyone else other than God. And so they resist the king's food. Here's where we find that second, the Lord gave statement. And by the way, I told you the first point would be when we spend our most time with. That was a really long point. Don't worry, point two and three will be much shorter. The second, the Lord gave. It says in verse 9, the Lord gave Daniel and his friends favor with their captors so they could resist the king's food and thereby not swear allegiance. And yes, the NIV says something different, but this is what it says in the Hebrew. The Lord gave them favor. The application here is to guard your heart and to trust that God will do the same. It's to draw a line, to put some guardrails up, some boundaries to help you stay in the fold. And the book of Daniel doesn't tell us where to draw the line, but it does tell us that it's important to draw the line. I mean, as the old cliche says, right? If you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. Or as G.K. Chesterton says, when men choose not to believe in God, they do not thereafter believe in nothing. They then become capable of believing in anything. The application is to be intentional, to draw some boundaries and to protect the rhythms of your life so that you aren't open to believing things that aren't true, to ground yourself in practices that keep you connected to God so that you don't end up becoming disconnected from God. By refusing the king's food, Daniel would be reminded three times a day who really was his king and who wasn't his king. Three times a day, he would dine with God, and thereby he would profess his allegiance to God. And of course, he does this in private, which is an important thing to recognize here. Daniel doesn't use his faith as a sledgehammer to crush his enemies with. He doesn't flaunt his faith in trying to establish some sort of culture war in the midst of Babylon. He simply asks for permission to do what he needs to do to guard his own heart. By the way, he also doesn't criticize his fellow Jews, most of which went along with every part of Babylon's plan. The only four who asked to resist are Daniel and his three friends who are mentioned here. I think that's an important point because Daniel doesn't criticize other people. He doesn't make them try to move up to his standards. He simply does what he thinks is important for him. And he does so privately, and he does so very graciously. Notice how Daniel responds to his captor here. He doesn't take God's favor for granted so he can just be a jerk. He actually very respectfully asks. He even says, please. What's remarkable is that even though this would be an act of sedition for Daniel to not eat this food, even though his captor, it would be considered an act of sedition for him to not serve Daniel and his friends the food, the servant obliges. And that's where we find the last, the Lord gave statement. Verse 17, to these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams. God gives Daniel and his friends straight A's in their classes. And which I wish the application here was, if you just trust God, you won't ever have to study again. But that's not the point. God doesn't download information into our heads here. He does bless obedience. He does promise to be with us, and he promises to use us when we stay faithful to him and to perhaps even open up doors to be used for his purposes. In the case of Daniel, he's given the ability to interpret all sorts of dreams and visions, which, as we'll see in later chapters, allows him to prophesy some very remarkable things about the coming of Jesus and the resurrection of the dead, and all sorts of other things about the end of time. It also gives him access to one of the most powerful men the world has ever seen. And it gives him an opportunity actually to influence this man's faith as well as his predecessors. The thing about Daniel is he spends his entire life in exile. From about 13 to 14 years old, he dies in Babylon. Not because he didn't choose to go back to Israel, he just didn't get a chance to go back. He spent his entire life in exile. The remarkable thing is not a day of his life is wasted. That's because Daniel didn't pout and say, woe is me, I'm in this terrible place. It's because he didn't hole up and protect himself. It's because Daniel chose to be faithful. And he put some safeguards in his life so that he wouldn't compromise his faith. And he remained faithful to God, even as the cost became pretty great, and they will get pretty great in coming chapters. God used Daniel for his purposes, and it shaped the lives of many. And this is the example that Scripture invites us to follow. This is the calling that actually God calls us to embrace. To be faithful in all things. Not to expect others to, not to force others to, not to try to fight some kind of war, but actually to be faithful to God and to graciously point others to Him. Now, in the coming weeks, we'll talk about a lot of specific things about what this means for us here in the Pacific Northwest, here on the east side, and here in the greater Bellevue area. But today, I simply want us to recognize the fact that the good news, which is found in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, is expanded and extended by the faithful acts of those who follow Jesus, who trust in the power of His resurrection and believe that God is at work by His Spirit. Even in the small acts of obedience. Remember that, particularly as we get ready to dine with the King today. You and I bear witness to the amazing grace of God. An amazing God does remarkable things through the faithful acts of ordinary people like us. So may we bear witness to Him. And may God be pleased to use us for His purposes.